They will build for me a sanctuary, and I shall dwell within them. At first glance, that verse from Exodus seems straightforward, but of course it's a translation. At what point does translation turn into interpretation or misinterpretation? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
How do the Old Testament's aesthetic trappings convey a religious, social, moral, and historical message? To what extent is the Bible literature? Does the Hebrew Bible come from a written or an oral tradition? Answering those questions and many others is our guest, Yair Mazur, professor of Hebrew and Biblical Literature at the UW-Milwaukee. He is the author of a variety of books, including Who Wrought the Bible? Unveiling the Bible's Aesthetic Secrets, to be published in January 2009 by the University of Wisconsin Press.
And welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
Well, let's start with this idea of secrets of the Bible, but not just any secrets, but aesthetic secrets.
Yeah.
We all know what secrets are, and we all know when you say Old Testament what we're talking about, but what about aesthetic?
Well, traditionally, aesthetic is associated with the concept of beauty. I believe, however, that it is a mistake because beauty is a subjective term and there is no way whatsoever to define plausibly beauty. And I think that we need another definition, another approach to the concept of aesthetic. And aesthetic, the way that I see it, is a concept which is associated with the structure, and now I'm talking about literature, with the structure of the text, the way that the text is organized. It is also associated with the diction, with the choice of words, with metaphors, with synecdoches, with analogies, with parallels, with a variety of devices which aim to approach the reader and dictate the way that the reader will relate to the text. I'll give you an example, for instance, from the verse that you just cited from the book of Exodus. And the verse is the following: they will make or build for me a sanctuary, and I will dwell within them. As long as we do not relate to aesthetic, our inclination is to believe that it is a rather simple verse or phrase that tells about the process of establishing a sanctuary and the promise of God to dwell within them, the nation, the people. However, the way that I read it does introduce a latent irony, because God says they will establish, they will build a sanctuary for me, while believing that that is going to be the place of my dwelling. However, in the second part of this phrase, he does contradict that expectation, because he says, I will dwell within them, not in the sanctuary. So in other words, what he's trying to say, the sanctuary is fine, but what is more paramount is that I will dwell in their hearts.
Within them and not within it.
Yeah.
This is God speaking and saying that contrary to their expectations, I will be where they don't necessarily expect me to be.
Yeah, exactly so.
And what difference does it make when you look at that same phrase in Hebrew?
In Hebrew, it is more clear that irony is invested in the text. And this irony serves the ideological message of the verse, of the phrase, and the ideological message, which in this case is a religious message, that people cannot expect that once they build a sanctuary for God, they are done with their obligations to God. They must create a situation that they are sufficiently righteous to the point that God will be willing to dwell within them, in their hearts.
So this is setting up, if I'm not mistaken, part of the whole dichotomy in the Bible between the material and the spiritual.
Exactly so. And so many prophets talked about the sacrifices, the burnt offerings,
yes,
while arguing that it is nothing but a tool to get closer to God, but it is not necessarily the most important tool. What is more important is to cultivate moral behavior.
I'm reminded a little bit of Abraham and Isaac, where the sacrifice is not carried out because God says you have the right attitude, the right spirit.
Yeah,
we don't literally need for you to sacrifice your son.
Very correct indeed. Yeah.
Well, let's look at that sacrifice. As you turn aesthetic or literary eyes on that passage, on that story, what difference does it make to read it through that lens?
Oh, it makes a great difference. Because I can give you an example, and there are several examples of such a nature in the story of the sacrifice of Isaac. For instance, the very beginning of this story, it starts with that sometime after those things, according to the Hebrew translation, God put Abraham to test. Now, when I read God put Abraham to test, my conclusion is that it is nothing but a test. It is not something which is about to materialize. Nevertheless, Abraham is devoid of such a knowledge. He doesn't know that it is nothing but a test. So there is an ironical gap between what I, the reader, know and what Abraham knows. Now, what is the purpose of that ironical gap? The biblical narrator or writer or editor wants the reader to focus as intensively as possible on Abraham, on his righteousness, on his willingness to obey God's command, as atrocious as it may be. And if the reader will not know from the very beginning that it was nothing but a test, the reader would have concentrated on the chronicle, on the evolving plot, and not on Abraham, because the wish upon the part of the reader will be to find out whether it's going to happen or not, like in a thriller.
Yes.
And the biblical narrator wants to avoid it. So from the very beginning, he tells the reader, look, nothing is going to happen. It is nothing but a test. But Abraham, of course, doesn't know that. another example for the aesthetic infrastructure which is invested in the text and the way that it influences the way that the text is perceived by the reader. Abraham, after the command of God, we read that he rose early in the morning and he saddled his donkey and he took his two lads, servants with him, and Isaac, his son, and he cleaved the wood for the burnt offering and he went to the place that God told him. Now, there is here a list or a cluster of activities, and the order of presentation of those activities does not have to be necessarily the way that it is introduced in the text. Well, the first one must always be the first one to get up early in the morning. However, he can first take the two lads, the two servants, and then to saddle the ass, the donkey, and then to cleave the wood for the burnt offering, and then to take Isaac with him. And there are other options for the order of presentation.
So what is the significance of this sequence?
First, it says that he rose early in the morning. God didn't tell him to start so early in the morning, but he does it. And the reason is that here we encounter Abraham, the pious believer, who desires to fulfill God's command as soon as possible with no delay. However, there is another Abraham here, Abraham the father, and there is a conflict between the two Abrahams, because Abraham the father wants to delay as much as possible the atrocious act which he is expected to perform.
He's waited a very long time to have this son, we should add. This isn't just one of many, but he really had to wait a long time till his old age.
Yeah. And for this reason, he, for instance, saddles the donkey by himself. Now, we have to realize that to saddle the donkey is a phrase that indicates a very long and hard work, because he has to prepare all the food and all the water for four people for a three-way walk in the desert, one day for worship, and three more days coming back from the desert for 7 days. So he has to prepare all is required to go on such a trip. And I believe that this is a demonstration of the second Abraham. Abraham, the father, who tries to delay as much as possible the sacrifice of his son. And for this reason, we read that he takes the servants only after he completed the work. It doesn't make sense, because that is the function of the servants, to do the work. But he prefers to do it alone.
One thing at a time rather than simultaneously.
Yeah. This way he earns time. And maybe God will change his mind. Maybe something will happen. Also, when he keeps the act of cleaving the wood for the burnt offering for the last. And there is a psychological reason here, which is also associated with Abraham, the father, the loving father, because this act is the one that is directly engaged with the atrocious act which he is about to commit. So he tries to delay it as much as possible.
The cutting of the wood that will make possible the sacrifice of his son. Mm.
So in other words, we realize that the order of presentation in which the acts are introduced to the reader is not a random one. It is motivated by emotional, religious, psychological reasons.
So your argument would be that the writer of that passage then is almost doing a character study.
Yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yes, and it is certainly at odds with opinions displayed by many scholars who argue that in the Bible there is no description of what they call the internal life of the characters. It is not done directly in the Bible, but indirectly through their actions. We can learn a lot about the internal life of the characters.
Now, what about the, you mentioned diction as another thing you look at, the word choice, just the way it makes a profound difference if I say, I have to do a program with you as opposed to I get to do a program. Just one word, one verb can change a tone. In the passage that you're talking about, are there particular word choices that strike you as revealing?
Well, the first one is the one that we already addressed, that he rose early in the morning. In Hebrew, it is one word, vayashkem, which etymologically is associated with shoulder. And the reason is that they used to get up early in the morning in order to start working, avoiding the blazing sun. So this word that he got up early in the morning is an indication how the diction makes a difference, how the diction reflects the idea behind it. Another example is when he approaches the two servants after they reach the place, and he tells them, sit here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go, will worship, and we shall return to you. He uses the word we, but he already knows that it is going to be I, not we, because Isaac is about to be sacrificed.
So what? An important difference, isn't it? Yes. Is he lying to them so that they won't try to interfere?
Exactly so.
Or denying it to himself as
well? Or denying to himself. Because we have to keep in mind that we are talking about the ancient East, where people believed in the power of words. And as long as they did not utter the word, they still have a chance that the action behind the word will not materialize.
What about the problem of multiple authorship? I mean, as you're doing this very, very close reading of passages, whether it's from Exodus or Genesis or wherever you're looking, what do you see in terms of multiple styles?
Well, it is more than certain that in putting together the text, many people were involved, and from different periods of time, sometimes even 1,000 years separated between one author and a second one, and eventually the editor. And they tried their very best to cultivate the impression that it was put together by one author. They tried their very best to create the impression that there is no language discrepancy between phrases. And it brings to my mind, for instance, the example in the book of Genesis, in the two stories of the creation of human beings. The first story is about God who creates simultaneously a male and a female, and he tells them, multiply, fill the country, and rule the country. Later on, however, there is a second version of the creation story, which is dramatically different. God creates from the soil, from the earth, Adam, the man, not the woman yet. Later on, however, God decides that it is not good for the man to be on his own, and he creates from the rib of Adam the woman, the female. Now, Adam, in the second story, gives a name to the woman, and it is neither random nor arbitrary, because naming in the Bible means creation, or at least upgrading in the status of the person.
God asks his created humans to name all those creatures.
Exactly. And in a minute I'll focus on it, because it is very intriguing why he gives this task to Adam. However, Adam names the woman, and he says, this time she is flesh of my flesh, and for this reason I will call her Isha, because in Hebrew Ish is a man, so she's going to be Isha. Now, there is no doubt that at least two words were added by a later editor, and the words are this time, because they are quite enigmatic. How come that Adam was aware of the first story of creation before he was created? It doesn't make sense. But the later editor wanted to justify putting together in one chapter two stories which reciprocally contradict each other. And he tries to create a sort of a hook that will put together these two stories. So as if Adam says, well, the first time didn't work out well. So this time it worked much better. And I will name the woman. About naming the animals, it is quite interesting the way that it is put in the Bible, because God tells to himself, it is not good for Adam to be on his own. I will create a helper for him. And then God brought to Adam all the animals, all the beasts of the field, all the birds. And here is a device of frustrated expectations, because he doesn't tell Adam, why don't you choose one of those animals to be your mate? He tells Adam, I want you to name them, not to choose them. And the question is why? God wanted to make a point that none of the animals can be a mate for Adam. And he does it through the act of naming, because when man names the animals, he becomes superior. He becomes a verbal creator. And this way he is expected to conclude that the animals are not for him to mate. So here we can see how the text utilizes a rhetorical device of breached expectations in order to deliver a message.
Well, and are you saying then it makes Adam, in effect, like the god of these animals? He's playing God in the
exactly
sense that
so.
Naming is creating.
Exactly so. And it serves quite well another section when it comes to the interaction between Adam and Eve. At the time, she was not called Eve yet. So man and the woman. Because God wanted to make a point that Adam is the superior one. Also because he named the woman and he called her Isha. And later he called her Eve, which means the mother of all living people. But that plan on the part of God did not materialize well because the woman was much more intellectually oriented than man. And the biblical narrator made a lot of effort to belittle the intellectual faculties of the woman, because the agenda of the Bible is that the male is the superior one, not the woman. So the Bible cannot afford letting the woman eclipse and cloud the verbal, the intellectual superiority of Adam. So for instance, when it comes to the tree of knowledge.
I was wondering how the apple and the serpent and Adam and Eve play out in this concept of who's intellectually superior.
Correct. So God tells the reader and also, of course, Adam, he tells them that he created in the Garden of Eden two trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge. However, each and every tree does not have only a given name, but also a surname. The surname of the tree of knowledge is good and evil. The surname of the tree of life is the tree in the middle of the garden. Now, when the serpent approaches the woman, he tries to tease her, and he tells her, you know, God does not let you eat all the fruits of the trees in the garden. And she responds, well, we can eat all the fruits that we may wish. However, there is only one tree that we cannot touch, which is the tree in the middle of the garden. She makes a mistake. She meant the tree of good and evil. The tree in the middle of the garden is the tree of life.
Now, how do we know she made a mistake as opposed to a deliberate choice?
I believe that the writer is the one who put the words in her mouth in order to serve his ideological message, because this way she stumbles when it comes to verbal faculties, and verbal faculties are associated with intellectual faculties, because we can think only about matters that we can formulate, that we can verbalize. So he deliberately makes her making a mistake when it comes to the name of the tree.
But she comes around and convinces Adam, however, and pulls him in on mistake.
Oh, yes.
So where does he stand in the hierarchy of intelligence here?
He's pretty low.
So what happened to the agenda then, if he's pretty low?
Well, there is another attempt to belittle the intellectual faculties of the woman. What is the reason? Or let me start this way. We all know for thousands of years that the first sin, the first iniquity that was committed was the temptation. And there are so many sexual connotations, or at least sensual connotations, engaged with this temptation. My argument is that it is wrong. There was nothing sexual or sensual in that temptation. It was purely intellectual. How do I know? The woman is convinced to eat the forbidden fruit only after the serpent promises her that she will acquire divine knowledge like God himself, knowing the difference between good and evil.
That's certainly an intellectual appeal, a philosophical appeal.
Exactly. And that was the only reason that made her breach the command of God. However, later, a couple of phrases later, the biblical narrator tells us that she decided to disobey God for three reasons. First, she found the tree, and the way that it is put in the Hebrew is lustful to the eyes.
Lustful to the eyes. Now, in English, lustful can mean having to do with a sexual attraction.
Exactly. And he did it deliberately because he wanted to engage her with sexual connotations. The second reason that he argues that made her eat the forbidden fruit was because it seemed to her very tasty. It is also a sensual reason. If you may wish, it may be also engaged with sexual connotations.
With appetite.
So with appetite, the act of eating.
Well, fruit, of course.
Yeah, of course. And only the third reason does mention something associated with wisdom, with knowledge. She found the tree desirable to acquire knowledge. But even this part, which is engaged with knowledge, starts with desirable. So in other words, the biblical narrator gives us three false reasons why she ate the fruit. They are not only false, but they are also sexually oriented.
So he's dismissing her as sexual rather than intellectual.
Exactly so.
More on the aesthetic secrets of the Bible when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air.
Ele toldot Noach. Noach, ish tzadik tamim, haya bedorotav. Et ha-Elohim, hithalech Noach. Vayoled Noach, shlosha vanim, et shem, et cham, ve-et yefet.
This is the line of Noah. Noah was a righteous man. He was blameless in his age. Noah walked with God. Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth.
That's passages from Genesis, first in Hebrew and then in English. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Yazir Mazur, and we are talking about aesthetic secrets of the Old Testament. You know, hearing you read it in Hebrew, it brought up this idea of sound and the sort of the oral nature of the Bible. Can you talk a little bit about that and whether you think some of what we have written down comes from first being perhaps recited?
Well, There is no doubt that the biblical text utilizes many sound patterns that cannot be translated into other languages. And not only the sound patterns, also the metrical pattern, the rhythmical pattern, also the way that the words are organized along the textual continuum is unique to the biblical text and cannot be translated into other languages, because in other languages the syntax is different. We have to keep in mind Hebrew is an ancient Semitic language that does not correspond in so many ways to other languages like English in this case.
So there are places, I assume, where translation is a problem to get the exact meaning of the original, the cultural context. But also translation, of course, can lead to mistranslation.
Very, very correct. And I'll give such an example in the following passage that I would like to discuss. In this case, the English translation doesn't do much injustice to the Hebrew. Well, it sounds different, but it does deliver the content of the passage quite precisely. Now, in both the Hebrew and the English, one can trace a latent aesthetic device which, like in other cases of the biblical text, does serve the ideological message. And in this context, I would like just to make one comment that the Bible per se is not literature, and we can talk about it later. It is a text of historical qualities, religious qualities, social, moral, and others that utilizes aesthetic mechanism, that its function is to enhance the ideological message. But for the Bible, the ideological message is the one that comes first. Now, in this case, we read the following. This is the line of Noah. Noah was a righteous person. He was blameless in his age. And the word in Hebrew instead of age is in his generations.
And that's what it says in the King James translation. I think it says Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations.
Yeah. It is closer to the Hebrew text. And it says that Noah walked with God. However, as a person who focuses on the aesthetic quality of the text, I encounter here an aesthetic device which is rhetorical in the sense that it tries to influence the way that the text is perceived by the reader. And in this case, the rhetorical device consists of frustrated expectations. How come? Well, we read, this is the line of Noah. Noah was a righteous man. He was blameless in his age. My argument is that this verse does contradict what was promised in the previous verse. This is the line of Noah. I want to hear, to read about the line of Noah. With all due respect, I am not interested right now in the characteristics of Noah, in his being a righteous person, blameless, somebody who walks with God. This is not what promised to me.
So you're saying the order
sets,
you think you're going to hear about the line of Noah, and then we have a kind of a side route.
Exactly.
And why should we care about the line of Noah, though, if we don't know a little something about him, that he was a person of exemplary character?
Correct. Very correct. And only later, this lack is compensated when we read, Noah begot three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So my question is, what is the reason that the order of presentation is quote-unquote abused logically, and instead of materializing what was promised, we get something which takes us by surprise? I believe that the reason for that is engage with one word only: age, generations. It says that Noah was a righteous person in his age, in his generations. Now, we already know that his age was a sinful one, one that committed atrocious iniquities.
Which is why this flood is being brought down
exactly.
in the first place.
And if this is the case, maybe Noah was not such a righteous person. Only in comparison with the sinful guys in his generation, he could be considered a righteous person.
Oh, so he's relatively righteous. He's the best that was available.
Exactly.
Not necessarily top grade.
But how does that help help us understand why even begin with this as the line of Noah? Why not start that with Noah was a righteous man?
Well, the reason is that the biblical writer tries deliberately to create a device of frustrated expectations that lead to surprise. And this surprise falls directly on the word age, generations. And this way, the biblical writer tries to compensate for the relatively lack of righteousness of Noah, and to emphasize that, after all, he was a righteous person. So the biblical text tries to do something quite demanding. On the one hand, to deliver what he believed that was true, that only relatively Noah was a righteous person. On the other hand, he tries to compensate for this relative perspective and to introduce Noah as a truly righteous person.
Well, a lot of it, if it hinges on the word age or generations, as it's sometimes translated, how much then does the Hebrew choice of that word and the kind of meanings associated with it, the connotations of the Hebrew word, what difference does that make? Because you can read generation both in terms of the time he lives in, but also the time after him.
Yeah. Well, in the Hebrew, it is his own generations, not generations that came after him.
And, okay. And yes, and when it's translated in his age, that also has multiple meanings too. It's interesting how much hinges on just a few words and how they're translated.
Well, I'm sort of intrigued. Maybe it's a red herring here, but by this concept of the righteous survivor, and I'm thinking of Lot.
Yeah.
And also, if we're talking about female yielding to temptation, his wife who turns to see the destruction and turns into a pillar of salt for it.
Well, the Bible is quite anti-feminist.
Yes.
And to say it in a subtle fashion, and we can see it, for instance, in the case, as you mentioned, the wife of Lot, that was portrayed as somebody who denies the command of God and looks backwards. and she was punished heavily. Also, in another section, and there are so many sections, and it goes back to the issue of choosing words. When Abraham goes down to Egypt with Sarah, and he tells her to be an impostor, to tell her that she is his sister, not his wife, because otherwise he will be killed by the Egyptians. So when Sarah is mentioned in the context of the Egyptians who will buy her, she's not called Sarah anymore. The woman as a piece of merchandise. Now, also in this case, one can track down a very subtle aesthetic mechanism that incriminates Abraham. When Abraham approaches the land of Egypt, he says to Sarah, "Why don't you say that you are my sister and not my wife? Because had they known that you are my wife, they would kill me. And if you are my sister, so they can buy you." Now, he gives her two reasons why she should do that. He says to her, first, "So this way I will benefit from it. And second, this way I will stay alive." The Bible very shrewdly distorts the logical order of presentation. The major reason is, of course, that I shall stay alive.
Yes.
And the second reason, that I will benefit from it. But the Bible reverses this order of presentation and makes Abraham this way a greedy person.
And more interested in gain than his own life, by implication.
Exactly. And for this reason, also the Bible, when she is sold to Pharaoh, the Bible gives us a very long list of presents that Abraham got from Pharaoh. Now, what is interesting, that the Bible uses the very same wording by Abraham, "I will benefit from it." The Bible says, "And Abraham was benefited from it, and he got donkeys and slaves and camels, etc., etc., etc." So the Bible wants to deliver the message that the plot, the conspiracy, had been completed to its fullest, to the iota, word by word. And also, as far as I know, and I'm not talking now about an aesthetic device, but about human nature, human feelings. When Abraham is pretty close to the border with the Egyptians, and he realizes that he has to sell his wife to Pharaoh, and that is for good, how come that he doesn't stop and says to himself, "Enough is enough. I'm not willing to sell my wife for good in order to benefit." Also, in this context, we have to realize that Abraham was a mighty leader of a powerful tribe. He could make it in the land of Canaan, despite of the famine. But he goes on with his plan. And what does he think to himself when he parts from Sarah for the last time, and the evening falls, and he knows that she is in the palace of Pharaoh, and probably they don't play chess?
I suspect not.
And how could he deal with death emotionally? Another subtle aesthetic device which is invested in the story is that when Abraham ascends to the land of Israel, he takes Lot, his nephew, with him. However, when he goes down to Egypt, Lot is not mentioned. And the reason is to make clear that if Lot could make it in the land of Israel, in the land of Canaan, despite of the famine, most certainly Abraham could do that as well. He was much more affluent and powerful than Lot. So in this case, deleting Lot is an aesthetic device that delivers a message that incriminates Abraham.
Well, we could have quite a long and very fascinating series with you, looking through many, many of these fascinating biblical passages that have more than meets the eye. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Yair Mazur, for being with us today.
Thank you very much indeed.
It's been a great pleasure. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Join us next Sunday afternoon at 4 for University of the Air as we look at some of the results of oxygen deprivation for Olympians and for mountaineers and for racehorses. That's next Sunday afternoon at 4 here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.